All right, you guys, welcome to another episode of the Strain 4 Podcast. This is episode 6. Today's guest, I'm very excited about. His name is Michael Kummer. He's Austrian, correct? He's Austrian. He is, so I know from the gym, you're a dude that I know you as, this is going to sound ridiculous. When you take your shirt off, it was like, hold on a second. This guy's like in really good shape, like impressively good shape. And so today, for you guys out there watching and listening, we're going to dive into his health, fitness, nutrition background. He's incredibly smart. He's got his own supplement line. He does a lot of really great things. He does some homesteading, like all of it. And so the goal is to provide you all with a ton of value. Without further ado, Mr. Kummer, take it away. Tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of how you got into health, fitness. Maybe start with early years. Austrian sprint champion, like the whole thing. I want to hear it all.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And you know, funny enough, when you said that, you know, when I saw you work out, I'm like, holy shit, this guy's fit. You know,
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And yeah. So you know, born and raised in Austria. At some point during in high school, I got into track, and I think actually my PE teacher told me, you know, you guys should try out track. You know, but my buddy and I really, we started, you know, together, and then we, you know, made it all the way to the European, you know, championships back in the days. And it was really one of the, I think, most impactful times of my life, because I learned that just because I feel something doesn't necessarily mean it indicates the my physical limit to something, you know.
I want you to expound on that. That's a really good point.
Specifically, I mean, you know, when you start working out, whatever it is, or you know, doing any sort of, you know, physical activity, you at some point you reach a limit where you think like you can't do it anymore. You know, there is nothing more you can do. And it turns out there is, you know, it's just your mind, you know, putting, you know, up like a limit of, you know, be careful because you might get hurt if you continue, but that's not your real limit, you know. And I discovered that my track coach at the time, he trained with the Russians, you know.
I'm sure that was a lot. Russians.
He was pretty tough. I mean, the first couple of, you know, trainings, he wouldn't even, you know, talk to us, critique us, nothing. He would just, you know, he told us later that, you know, we got to pluck out anyway, so it's not even worth, you know, his time telling us anything. And he was pretty hardcore. You know, it was, in his opinion, like, you know, you don't have to, you know, if you want to lie down and do that, you know, that's fine, but you're never going to make it. It was kind of his thing.
Wow.
And that really, you know, not everyone can handle this, I think, but it kind of stuck with me. And there was one specific workout. It was in the winter. You know, we had to, it was snow outside on the track. You know, there was only one lane, kind of free where we could run. And we were doing intervals, like 200 meters or whatever. And I would throw up and would just lie there. And usually in the past, you know, my training was done at that point. You know, I would throw up and I was done. I knew I couldn't do it anymore. It went to my physical limit. And one day he said, well, you know, we're going to go inside now and you can choose to stay there or you continue the workout. And I got up, I threw up, I got up and I continued to work out. I'm like, I can actually do it. You know, this is just, obviously there was something. You don't want to do this every day.
Right.
But there is this learning curve where, you know, once you've, you know, crossed that threshold, you can then perform at a much higher level.
Dude, I'm so glad you're hitting on that, man. That is so huge. And to this day, I think the only workouts I've ever thrown up from were track workouts, 100%. I was telling someone today, a client, I think they're the most underutilized tools after a certain age for fitness. And you're right. Once you experience like that moment where I don't think I can keep going, and then you get up and you keep going anyway, or someone's like, hey, come on, just do it with me, even if it's your bros. And then you do it and you're like, oh my gosh, like I have a lot more in the tank than I thought. Yeah. I think it's so awesome you're hitting on that.
Yeah. And you know, that started my interest in fitness. But then I moved to the US and, you know, adopted the American way of life, you know, most of the bad things, including the standard American diet, unfortunately. And, you know, and I stopped working out, you know, I would go for a run every so often, or, you know, go to the gym, you know, to like, you know, LA Fitness or whatever, and, you know, curl a little bit, or, you know, but nothing really serious. And I realized over time, you know, my body was changing. It wasn't, you know, when I was young and, you know, I could eat whatever, even while I was a pro athlete, I didn't really pay attention to any of the things that I pay more attention to now than working out, you know, sleep, diet, stress management, you know, environmental toxins, you know, hormetic stressors, you know, all of the things that I pay very close attention to now, I did not at the time. And sometimes I kind of wish, like, you know, I knew what I know now, because I think I would have performed better.
Yeah.
Even despite my youth mitigating many of those, you know, stupid decisions that I made at the time. And, but, you know, I moved to the US, adopted an American diet, and my gut health, you know, took a nosedive. I've always had, until that point, gut issues. Ran in the family, you know, I thought, you know, there's nothing I can do. And then at some point, I ran into a couple during a childbirth preparation class. And that guy, you know, they were friendly, you know, they were Latinos. My wife's Costa Rican, so we kind of connected on that, you know, level. And we started hanging out, and we noticed this guy's eating differently. You know, he doesn't eat any grains, and, you know, no dairy, no legumes. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I'm on a paleo diet. And I'm like, what is that? And I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of trying to mimic, you know, how our ancestors, you know, ate. Or at least those people, you know, depending on how far back you think, you know, humans go.
Sure.
That's kind of how they ate, and that's what I'm mimicking because it's healthier for me.
Yeah.
And, like, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You do you, and
how about you doing this?
Exactly. I just, you know, keep rocking. And then at some point, you know, my wife and I actually watched a documentary about the amount of added sugars the average American consumes annually. It was like, you know, bags of sugar. I mean, it's ridiculous. And my wife was diagnosed with pre-diabetes at the time and had headaches all the time. And, you know, and with me with my gut issues and my, you know, physique kind of looking the way it did. We got to do something, you know, we're going to cut out all added sugars. And so we did that and immediately felt better, both of us.
Really?
And then I, you know, went back to my buddy and said, hey, you know, tell me more about this paleo diet. You know, I'm interested. And so he kind of explained the concept. I'm like, you know what, I'm going to do this too. So I went back to my wife and said, starting tomorrow, I'm going to do paleo. And she's like, you know, I'm the one cooking. What do you mean you're doing paleo? You know, I'm not cooking for you, you know, separately, you know. And so we got into a huge argument. And I'm at the time, at least, and I still am to a degree, a fairly black and white kind of guy. You know, if I set my mind to something, I bulldoze over everything in my way. And that really put that was a significant discussion we had at the time. I remember that. And I'm like, you know what? Whatever. You know, I don't do paleo. You know, we just all die painfully, you know, sooner than we should.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know. Played that part with my wife, and she started investigating, and, like, you know, she said, you know what, I think that paleo is a good thing, we should do paleo. I'm like, right on,
let's do it. That's great.
Let's do paleo. So we did paleo, and seriously, from one week to another, all my gut issues were gone.
Really?
And then, but paleo at the time for us was a piece of steak and maybe grilled zucchini. You know, that was our idea of eating paleo.
Yeah.
And then over the years, you know, there are now everything can be paleo. You know, you can eat sweet potatoes and maple syrup all day and it's paleo, you know. But it doesn't really mimic how humans should be eating, right? Just because the food is paleo friendly or paleo compatible. And so we got more into paleo baking and paleo this and paleo that. And, you know, at some point then I discovered keto. I went to a conference. I'm like, keto, you know, that's really where it's at. It's not just paleo. You got to do keto, you know, if you really want to be, you know, as healthy as can be. And so I went back to my wife again and said, you know what? Paleo is not cutting it. We have to do keto.
same response.
Same response, exactly. Like, you gotta be kidding. You know, I already cut out, you know, rice and beans and all the stuff that I grew up on, and now you want to cut out all carbs?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, trust me, we have to do this. And he got into an argument again, you know, and I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know, we're not gonna do it. And then she did her own research, you know, and I said, you know what, I think we're eating too many carbs. You know, we need to be more metabolically flexible, and we need to be able to burn fat for energy, right? Not just glucose or carbs. And so we did that. And the thing is with keto, you know, that was already at the time where keto was fairly popular, and everything can be keto. You know, there is keto bread, there is keto, you know, with crap ingredients, seed oils, you know, what have you, but it's, you know, it hits the macro, so it's keto, you know?
Right.
And so it took us a while to realize that, you know, that version of keto doesn't really work for us. So we kind of backshift a little bit to a ketogenic paleolithic diet, you know, like at the combination of both ingredient quality and lowish carb kind of thing.
Right.
And it worked for us, but we also consumed a lot of things that we don't no longer do, like, you know, almond flour or nuts in general.
Yeah.
And I realized my gut issues were returning, you know. And then I ran into Paul Saladino in Costa Rica, and he told me about, you know, carnivore, and then, you know, a little bit later then his animal-based approach. And yeah, I went back to my wife and said, no, but I did it differently. And I said, you know what? I learned something. I would like to try it out. We don't have to switch. I would just, you know, I want to do it for 30 days. Yeah, let's just try it. I said I wanted to do carnivore, you know, and so I switched, you know, to carnivore, and again, my gut issues went away. I felt, you know, really good, but I also realized that this is probably not going to fly with Kathy, you know, eating meat only, you know. And I realized, you know, there is more to food than just, you know, the nutritional, the fuel aspect. You know, it's a social thing. It, you know, brings people together. It, you might have social, you know, certain emotional connections to certain foods, like the ones that I grew up with, you know,
yeah.
And just cutting all of that out, you know, might backfire, you know, or it might not be as effective as you want it to be if there is then, you know, if you're missing something from an emotional, social, you know, cultural perspective.
Yeah.
And so we kind of agreed on an animal-based approach. And even later, you know, most recently, in the last, you know, year or two or so, we actually discovered, we learned a lot from Dr. Bill Schindler about not only what you eat, but how you eat it. You know, humans have learned how to process certain foods to mitigate, you know, plant toxins, you know, fermenting, sprouting, soaking, heating, grinding, you know, all of those things that we are doing to food that makes it not ideal, but more compatible or less problematic.
Yeah.
And depending on, you know, your state of health, you know, your level of activity and numerous other factors, I think that you can get away with eating certain foods during certain times of the year without suffering any, you know, negative consequences. And so that's kind of the approach we settled on. And that's been, as a framework, working for us very well. It's predominantly animal-based. But, you know, there are certain things that I would not necessarily recommend for someone who's metabolically unhealthy or who has, you know, who is insulin resistant and stuff to consume. But if you're in, you know, like you and I, there's probably nothing wrong. Even, you know, I mean, I personally would never, well, I don't want to say never, but I don't see myself eating spinach, for example. But if you eat it once a year during that time when it grows and then not for the rest of the year, those oxalates in there are probably not going to harm you.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think that's a lot of context and nuance that's missing in a lot of conversations about nutrition, where it's, you know, you either do this or you're an idiot.
Right. Yeah. Well, actually, I want to ask you this question. So what are your thoughts on, because there's a huge debate around, you know, not eating vegetables, eating vegetables, like specific ones, especially because of the oxalates. And there's a school of thought that's, like you just said, black or white, don't do it, or if you do it, you're going to fail, and I think you're just going to die. But then there's the other school of thought that there's a hermetic response you get from consuming those oxalates that can be very similar to that of a sauna, an ice bath, where if you do any of those things for too long, it's dangerous, but the little bit you do gives you a benefit.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear what's your take on that?
I believe that to be true.
Yeah.
You know? I think there is a case to be made for exposing yourself to certain toxins or whatever in limited amounts to allow your body to respond and handle them better, knowing that if you consume spinach every day, you're probably going to end up with, you know, kidney stones and joint pain and whatever, you know, all of the things that come from, you know, oxalate exposure.
Yeah.
But doing it once every so often, I think it's perfectly fine, much like it is. You know, there might be differences in terms of how beneficial are certain hormetic stressors. Like I would argue, you know, jumping into the cold plunge every day has probably more benefits than eating spinach every day.
Mm-hmm.
But within the context of, you know, a little bit can make you stronger, I do believe that to be true.
Yeah, no, that's a really good thought. So then off the top of your head, I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but can you list out, like, what would be some vegetables that you would say, hey, these are a no-go or like a once-a-year thing, and these are vegetables that I would 100% consume often?
Yeah. I mean, I think that seasonal fruits are probably less problematic for most people because, you know, those are the parts of the plant that want to be eaten, right? An apple tree wants you to eat the apples and then poop the seeds so, you know, you can get another apple tree.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, eating the most vital parts of the plant, you know, the seeds, the stems, you know, the leaves, the skin in many cases, you know, is probably not so ideal. So I would say, for example, you know, taking something that I grew up with is potatoes, right? The most protective part of the plant is the skin because that separates, you know, the environment from the potato, right? Eating the skin that has the most defense chemicals is probably a very bad idea. And there's really no reason why you should.
Yeah.
But if you, you know, peel that potato, if you maybe soak it overnight and discard the water, then if you even ferment it in a saline solution, you know, to kind of get the starch content down. So when you then, you know, fry it with oil, you don't get those carcinogens that would normally form when you combine starches with high heat, you know, and fat. then it's a whole different, you know, animal.
Yeah, right.
And so I would say sweet seasonal fruits, cucumbers and squashes, if you remove the peel and or the skin and remove the seeds, yep. those are perfectly fine. You know, well, avocados are fruits, olives are fruits. Nightshades is something that a lot of people respond negatively to.
Yeah.
But even there, you know, with tomatoes, you know, if you remove the seeds and if you really want to go through the hassle of removing the skin, you know, the flesh itself is probably significantly less problematic. Mm-hmm. I personally stay away from leafy greens.
Really?
I don't really love them anyway, so yeah. it's not really a hard thing for me to cut out.
Yeah.
But oxalates are one of the things that are that I don't know any way of mitigating. You know, there is no cooking, fermenting, sprouting right. to get rid of the oxalates. So I typically, you know, stay away from those and stay away from most seeds, nuts and seeds, because yeah. I know I don't do well with those. And those are, again, you know, the most protected parts of the plant
yeah.
That you don't want to consume. And but, you know, having a handful of nuts every so often is fine. You know, if I go somewhere and there is a cheese board and there's a couple of almonds, whatever, you know, I pop some.
Yeah.
They're not going to do anything to me, but I would not, you know, eat like a bag of almonds every day.
Right,
you know?
Right. Now, okay, so tell me this. So this is a good segue into, you do homesteading
yeah.
currently. So do you get all of your nutrition from what you grow and have at your home? Or do you, you know, sometimes go to the store for whatever?
Yeah, like, no, what not yet. Like? Yeah, not yet. I mean, that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
But, you know, we just, and I like this property here, we just have an acre and a quarter.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome.
But we did buy 45 acres last year up in Menlo, which is about 2 hours away from here, where we can then take it to the next step and raise at least all of the protein we consume.
Right.
So right now we have chickens for meat and eggs. We have geese. We have bees for honey. We have a vegetable garden. But to be perfectly honest, I think our goal, midterm, is to grow all of the protein, all of the animal foods that we consume. And since we don't eat that many plants anyway, you know, we are okay buying yeah. because if there is something, you know, I don't know, another lockdown emergency, whatever, the Russians invade, whatever the case might be. You know, if we cannot get any veggies, yeah. we'd be fine.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one thing we don't need. No, we'd like to have some, but we don't need them. And so, yeah.
as long as you have the essentials,
yeah.
especially in that situation, that's really all yeah. that matters. Okay, so that's another great question. Was your motivation for homesteading more health or conspiracy? Or was it a combination of both?
Combination of both. I mean, conspiracy, you know, we have seen, you know, the last couple of years that things happen that I never thought would,
oh, yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and even to that extent where you cannot find eggs in the store anymore or whatever, you know, yeah. it's not too far-fetched to say there might be, again, a point in time where it's going to be difficult, more expensive, or in other ways prohibitive to buy the quality food that, you know, you want.
100%, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you heard this, but they being entities right. that be, were monitoring buying seeds that are, I think they're referred to as heirloom seeds,
mm-hmm.
where they like regrow every year.
Mm-hmm.
So you could buy these genetically modified seeds. You couldn't find any other version that mm-hmm. would give you one season of produce mm-hmm. and that's it. Not the yeah. way nature actually intended it.
I mean, that's exactly, you know, if you buy, you know, Monsanto, you know, seeds, then you have to buy them every year. And the thing is, you know, there have been cases where farmers have been fined for saving, you know, seed saving is something that farmers have always been doing. They keep the best seeds so they can grow them, you know,
yeah,
plant next year again. And, you know, Monsanto is going to find, you know, is going to find you if you do that. Or there have even been some cases where, I guess, the wind or whatever, you know, brought over some of those seeds to the neighboring property. And then they got fined, even though they never purchased from Monsanto. They don't even want that crap, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, it is the Wild West out there. And I don't think it's going to get any better. And so that was one consideration. But the quality of food was probably even the stronger argument, because we've realized as part of the growing and raising livestock that even the best grown food that you can buy is not good enough
yeah.
for what I would like to consume. And just to give you one example, you know, anytime there is the USDA involved, and with most food production there is, and you have to get, you know, if you want to, you know, grow chickens and sell them to the public, right? And so you are in a USDA inspected kind of facility. That chicken is being bathed in chlorine before it's packaged.
Yeah.
It's not only bathing, it's swimming in chlorine, you know, for a while. And the type of chicken that is raised, the Cornish cross, is a genetic freak that has so many health issues that grows from birth to butcher in like 45 days to eating fat, obese babies that can't even walk anymore because their breasts are so big that they cannot, their legs are not strong enough to sustain their body weight. They cannot reproduce. They're a dead end from that perspective. And those are 99% of the chickens that you buy in the store. And I'm like, I don't want to have, you know, either of that. And then they are fed a feed that increases the omega-6 ratio in their body fat, because all monogastric animals, they are what they eat, much like humans. And if you eat crap food, you know, you see it in your own health and in your fat tissue, etc. And so we couldn't find any chicken that is not Cornish cross and that is raised on a low PUFA, you know, low polyunsaturated fatty acid diet, meaning no corn, no soy, no vegetable oil binders to bind the minerals to the seeds, etc. Didn't exist until recently. And so we said, you know, we got to do it ourselves. And, you know, we concluded that it cost us approximately $30 to $35 to raise one chicken that way. You know, if I was in the chicken business, I would have to sell a chicken for $50,
yeah,
you know, to make profit. Nobody's going to buy them, you know. Right. So if I buy a chicken for $10 in the store or whatever it costs, I don't even know, you know what type of chicken it is,
yeah,
you know. And that's not something I want to eat. And the same goes with, you know, we buy until, you know, now an entire cow each year from a local farm here, but it's processed or butchered in a USDA facility. So we cannot get, you know, certain organs, because it's not allowed according to USDA rules.
Really?
So we cannot even eat nose to tail if we wanted to, you know, and the list goes on and on. I mean, you know, raw milk and, you know, labeled for pet food, the one we buy, you know, because it cannot be, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and it begs the question why they would be monitoring it like that and keeping you from being able to eat nose to tail and all the things. And that's where you can definitely go down the path of all the conspiracies
or
whatever.
You can think what you want.
It's 100% financial, I would say. Like, that's definitely one motivation. Mm-hmm. The other motivations, maybe that's another podcast, but it's really unfortunate. And I did not know that about all chickens in the superstores. Like, even like a good one, like a organic, if it said organic, whatever.
It just means that the chicken had organic feed, but it can be organic, you know, high PUFA feed. It doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah, so there's like scapegoats. They can kind of get around the terms and their definitions.
Yeah, they make it like, you know, the best thing that I've ever seen is you see it on egg cartons all the time from vegetarian fed hens. They are announcing on the label that they're feeding the chicken a wrong diet. Chickens are not herbivores.
Right.
They're not, you know, plant eaters. They are insectivores. You know, they are I would argue they are meat-leaning omnivores. Mm-hmm. You know, because if we see, you know, if we give them, you know, if we throw out, you know, if we butcher a rabbit or whatever, and we throw out the carcass, they go nuts over that. You
really?
Know, you give them some grains next to it, they wouldn't even look at it. You know, they go for the animal protein any time of the day. And that tells you, and they've not been influenced by, you know, ads and TV and our government.
Yeah.
They just eat what's natural, that what they think is best for them. And that is animal protein, you know?
That's so crazy. Yeah. So, okay, so let me ask you this. So as far as homesteading goes, do you eat your own chicken?
Mm-hmm.
Correct. How many chickens do you go through? Do you purchase? Like, what does that look like? You know, do you always have like 10 on deck that you're kind of rolling? I got
it. No, we typically butcher once or twice a year. So the last batch we had 30, and you know that lasts us for a little bit of a half. We don't eat chicken every day. We do maybe once a week or so, and so that's typically what we do. We raise them in batches. We butcher them in batches.
I see. So you'll buy a bunch of them, you'll butcher them, you'll freeze the meat,
correct,
and then pull from there. And then you have other chickens on your property that lay eggs.
Correct.
And
those are
keep those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're different breeds. Because
okay.
Our egg layers, you know, and occasionally you have to butcher one for whatever reason, and there is no meat on them. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And that's the other nuance, you know. Humans have not been raising chickens for meat until very recently. I'm talking a few decades ago. You know, in the past, you know, you would eat chicken in a soup or in a stew. If once the laying hen stopped laying, you know, it was basically, you know, turned into a stew or a stock or what have you.
Yeah.
But on a egg laying chicken, on a kind of on a heritage breed, there is no meat on that bird. You know, it's not worth it raising that chicken for meat. And so, you know, and then it's not as nutritious as the meat of a ruminant animal, you know. So the whole thing of, you know, they say, you know, this back in the days, it was like almost like something special when you had chicken dinner.
Really?
Uh-huh. Because chicken was so expensive, you know, and it was not something that, you know, now it's the cheapest meat you can buy almost.
Yeah, I mean, how many cars go through the Chick-fil-A line per day at every single store? It's insane. I've also heard not good things about the Chick-fil-A chicken and what's going on there. That's crazy.
None of the chicken. I mean, if you see how, you know, just drive up north a little bit, look at it. I mean, you cannot look at them because they're all fenced off and they're going to probably shoot you if you get close by, because you would see how the conditions, those chicken houses, absolutely awful. You know, absolutely awful.
Yeah, I mean, and it's unfortunate that Chick-fil-A is so good, because I'm guilty of it. It's fantastic. But when you really you boil it down and you look at what's going on, it's really convicting.
Yeah.
You're like, why am I consuming this in my body right now?
Yeah.
Man. All right, so tell me this. So you're homesteading. You got your kids into it, the whole thing. I mean, what has that been like as far as a family dynamic goes? Have they enjoyed it? Has it been fun? Are your kids into it? Like, the whole thing.
I think we had a little bit of everything. I mean, we are enjoying it, all of us. The kids have learned a lot, specifically when it comes to, you know, the circle of life, because there's death all the time, either because we butcher or because a hawk, you know, comes down and kills one of the birds, or, you know, someone gets sick, whatever the case might be. There is always new life and there is death. And that has been not only for the kids, but also for us, because, you know, I grew up in the city, you know, I never raised anything. And so that's been a very profound experience for all of us. And then just a learning curve of understanding, okay, how does, you know, food doesn't come from the store, you know, this is where it comes from. This is what you need to do to turn it into food. You know, this is, you need to raise that animal, love it for, you know, all days except one, you know, and then, you know, that animal has a bad life.
All days except one.
Yeah.
The big day.
And that's also something, you know, that a lot of people don't understand. How can you love an animal and then kill it? You know, how can you not? You know, we've learned. I mean, it's one of the, you know, most of our animals have names. You know, even the ones that we know have a very, you know, a limited lifespan. But at least while they live, they have the best life ever, or the best we can give them. You know, and then it's a bad day. But we're all going to have that bad day at one point, you know.
Man, that's a very profound point there. Yeah, I've thought about that too. And it's actually something that gets, this again goes into the whole politics and whatever your opinions on it. But like, people who I think are against killing an animal for food, like they don't understand. Like, that's literally how it happens. You go to the store, we're so detached from it. You go to the store and you buy a package of burger meat. It's like, how do you think that got there? You know, and it's just the reality of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I take issue with people who eat animals but don't want to know anything about where the food comes from. That's just, for me, incredibly stupid, you know. But I have even a bigger issue with those people who think that by not buying it, or by saying if you eat an animal, you are bad, and if you eat only plants, then you don't harm animals. Because those people in particular have never had a vegetable garden, have never had to pick off you know, hornworms of the tomato plant and kill those, because otherwise they would be eating your tomatoes and you would not have any harvest. And that's just, you know, in our local garden here, where we have, we can do those things by hand. You know, there is no collateral damage. If we see an insect on our plants, we can pick it off and feed it to the chickens, you know.
Yeah.
But we killed an animal at that point. Yeah, an insect, but nonetheless an animal. Now, you know, think about that on a larger scale, where, you know, machines come in and till and seed and harvest. You know, it's not only insects that get killed, it's rodents. You know, mammals get killed, you know, by harvesting or by producing plants for us to eat. You know, and so saying that, oh, I'm a vegan and, you know, and my food doesn't kill any animals, it's bullshit.
That
at least the animals that I kill, I eat, you know. Or our chickens eat, and then I eat the chicken, you know. But there is no collateral damage in the sense of, you know, I kill a bunch of deer, you know, that just happen to be in that field while I, you know, mowed over it.
It's just that detachment.
Yeah.
It's that just not understanding the actual process behind all of it.
Yeah.
And making that knee-jerk reaction and trying to, you know, play the hero or whatever it is you want to do. I love that topic, and I would love to talk more about that at some point. Diving into exercise.
Yes.
So, because this is a question I really want your opinion on. And I'm curious your thoughts. So, maybe not exercise, but just health and fitness. Mm-hmm. If you were to tell someone who came to you and said, hey, what are like the five main things I need to focus on to be the healthiest version of myself? What would you say? How would you define that? I'm very curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, there are like eight or so that I typically refer to. I think sleep is very foundational. I mean, you could argue what is the most important, you know. I think that the core ones are probably all important. But sleep, definitely. When if you don't sleep well, don't bother, you know. Don't cut your sleep short to go to the gym, you know, stuff like that. So sleep, number one. Diet, exercise, obviously, stress management, the avoidance of environmental toxins, which is another big thing that was fairly new to us. Like, you know, every time you put something on your skin, you know, or, you know, deodorant, any type of skincare product, tap water, you know, if it's not, you know, plastic water bottle. I mean, there are so many things that expose you to environmental toxins that can derail your health, you know, prevent you from losing weight or, you know, weight gain or causing infertility and a number of other things. So that is one thing. You know, reconnecting with nature, I think that's something that we all neglect. You know, just walk barefoot, you know, take your shirt off.
I'm huge on barefoot and shirtless. I love it.
Yeah. You know, be hot, be cold, you know, expose yourself to, you know, hormetic stressors, you know. I would probably start with, you know, hot and cold and not necessarily thick spinach as my exposure point first, but, you know, all of the things that make us uncomfortable, I think you should expose yourself to on a regular basis. You know, community is another big thing. You know, I've noticed that we have that luxury where we can try it ourselves without a community. You know, back in the days, if you had only one butcher in your village, yeah, you had to play nice with that guy because that's where your food came from, you know. Mm-hmm. Now we don't need that anymore. You know, we can do it. Everyone can be an idiot, you know. We don't have to talk to anyone because we can figure it out, you know, online or, you know, ordering or, you know, whatever the case might be. There's always another solution if we don't like, you know, that, you know, interaction point. But the truth is that we are not, you know, we are not meant to be alone. You know, we 100%. Are meant to be in a community. You know, any sort of, you know, spirituality. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not religious, but I think there is a lot in religion, in spirituality, you know, that helps you stay sane, in particular in times like, you know, we have today. So I think that's something you really, you know, need to work on, and stress management. I mean, many of those things kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, they all. Yeah.
But being able to not only manage your stress, but also have tools at your disposal to down-regulate when you need to, be it breathing, be it, you know, cold water immersion, be it, you know, exercise, whatever, you know, anything to kind of get you out of the fight or flight mode and be more, you know, zen.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your, I think I know the answer to this, but what's your, I kind of want to go through the list. What's your go-to form of training? Is it CrossFit? Like, do you just go to the gym and you follow the prescribed workouts, or do you do some other stuff?
Yeah, no, I mean, I used, you know, until maybe two or so years ago, and it was CrossFit 5-6 times a week. I think my main form of exercise right now is walking, as mundane as it may sound.
Walking's incredible. I just made a post about it. Yeah, I think walking's incredible.
Yeah, it's very low impact. You know, there's usually nothing that hurts when you just walk, you know, for a while. You know, if I cover, you know, let's say 5 miles or 5 kilometers, what have you, and I burn the same calories if I were to run, even though it gonna take me longer, sure, but it's low impact. It's not something that I've yet to find someone who's, oh, today I really don't want to walk.
Yeah,
you know, because it's so, I mean, you can think, theoretically you can do whatever while you walk, you know, and it's not going to bother you. And so that's one thing. But I also, I've taken up mobility more seriously now again. As I get, I mean, I'm turning 43,
yeah,
and I've noticed that I'm getting stiffer, you know, so that's one thing. But I'm also starting to, you know, show more interest in other things, and maybe taking up sprinting again, you know, like back in the days.
Yeah.
Swimming, you know, martial arts, just different movement patterns that I'm not used to, that I might not be good at, but I think that are very beneficial to kind of, you know, allow me to continue to move pain free, and don't look like a robot, you know.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so are you a fan I didn't hear you mention lifting weights, mm-hmm. but I know you do. I've seen you lift.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Are you a fan of lifting weights? Yes. Do you do it often? Do you not do it often?
I typically do CrossFit twice a week now.
Okay, so that's your way to think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because I think this is important. There's a difference, and you can attest to this probably. I'm 31, you're 43, mm-hmm. right? So there's a 12-year gap. And so I'm still in a phase where I am lifting pretty heavy mm-hmm. pretty often. Have you found that, you know, now that you're 43, if you lift too heavy too often, you beat your body up too much? Or are you able still to recover from it? You just don't quite enjoy it as much?
No, I absolutely love lifting.
Yeah.
And I still enjoy lifting heavy, especially the core exercise, you know, deadlifts, squatting, you know, those kind of things. I got a little bit more cautious, like with snatches and dynamic movements, where I'm like, it doesn't really benefit me to be able to snatch a certain, you know, weight.
Right.
But I want to be able, you know, to deadlift. I want to be able to squat. You know, I want to have, you know, the core kind of, you know, I want to be solid, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't need to learn, or I don't need to fine tune, you know, my snatching skills so I can snatch 300 pounds, you know.
Yeah.
That's, I'm like, that train has left the station, you know. I there's nothing for me to win anymore, you know, in that regard. I'd leave that to, you know, younger folk. But everything else I do enjoy very much. And I think lifting is important. I mean, if you don't, you know, put load on your structure, you know, stuff is going to get weaker. You know, your joints, your ligaments, your muscles, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I want to obviously keep that up and combine it with, you know, explosive type of movements. Yeah. And then, you know, some of the very low impact stuff like walking, swimming, etc. Kind of get a little, not a little bit of everything, but I want to be, I guess I don't want to suck completely at anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I made a post about that today too. Your fitness in that regard can be really simple. If you focus on your main lift, squat, bench, deadlift, you do some accessory work for your lower body and upper body. You pick a movement, whatever it is. And I mentioned sprinting mm-hmm. maybe one or two times a week. Mm-hmm. You walk. If you just do that mm-hmm. the rest of your life, you'll be incredibly fit.
Yeah.
You'll be in great shape.
Yeah.
So I love that you're saying that. I'm curious about this. So how do you, you mentioned sleep. I 100% agree. Sleep is so important. How do you optimize? Did you have anything specific you do to optimize your sleep? Because I know some people have like these crazy routines and they do all this stuff. Like, what do you do to optimize your sleep? You just get to bed on time and then just make sure you sleep?
I mean, pretty much.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I've tried, you know, also a number of, you know, different supplements, different routines, different, you know, gadgets, what have you. But whenever I get too much into, you know, like gadgetry, I kind of try to remember, you know, humans have been doing this, have been sleeping well, I would argue, for a very long time without any.
Yeah. You don't have to overcomplicate it.
You don't have to overcomplicate it. On the other hand, I do realize that the environment we live in today is very much different from maybe hundreds, you know, however long ago, you know, 5,000 years ago, you know. And I'm like, there is probably a need, because we cannot live how humans used to, or most of us can't or don't want to. You know, I don't want to live, you know, alone in a tribal community somewhere in the forest, you know, with a loincloth, you know. I kind of like the modern life, but it comes with a lot of things that make it more difficult to sleep well, you know, and make it more, you know. Modern life in many ways gets in the way of doing things right mm-hmm. or of making it easy to do things right. It's always or very often an uphill battle to do the right thing, to eat right, to sleep well. You know, it's, you always need to make an effort.
Because the wrong thing is so easily accessible.
Exactly.
Fast food is a perfect example.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But to get back to the question, you know, what I try is to keep a consistent sleep routine. Meaning, I get up roughly at the same time every day. I go to bed roughly at the same time, and I try to follow the sun as much as possible, so I don't go to bed, you know, when there's still light outside, and I don't eat, you know, after dark.
Yeah.
You know, kind of those basic kind of things. And and if I move enough during the day, if I expose myself to sunlight during the day, especially early in the morning, you know, I typically walk the dog early in the morning, so I get like, and if I see the sun come up, I just stand there and stare into the sun where it doesn't hurt it because it's so low for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I really get that, you know, sun exposure. I go out at noon and, you know, take off my shirt and, you know, just sit there in the grass.
Get some sun, some grounding.
And if I do, exactly, and if I do that, I tend to sleep well, and I don't, I've gotten rid of my Apple Watch.
Yeah, I don't do any of that stuff anymore.
I got rid of my iPhone for a while until I realized that a dumb phone is really incredibly dumb and nobody can communicate with me because everyone wants to send me an iMessage or a WhatsApp, you know? And I'm like, okay, maybe I don't have to go that extreme, but I leave my phone, you know, in the evening, I don't look at it anymore. It's not in my bedroom. You know, I put it in the office. I try to stay away from obviously stimulants. I don't drink coffee, you know, afternoon. I typically count my caffeine intake at 9 a.m., you know, so. And you know, I don't drink alcohol before going to bed, and you know, so all of the basic things that I know are can be sleep disruptors, and if I avoid them, I sleep
well. Everything's great. Yeah. Have you experimented with Andrew Huberman? You know Andrew Huberman? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think everyone knows him now. He's great. He talked about L-threonine, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. Have you?
I've tried a couple of those. I actually reviewed the Momentous Sleep supplement that I think Huberman was involved in formulating it, or at least he put his name on it so he can charge.
Make some money off it, yeah.
Money with it. I tried those. I am also a huge fan of Dr. Parsley's sleep remedy. He's an ex-Navy SEAL.
I have heard this guy. He's great, yes.
He's pretty good. He is a delicious tasting tea that has some of those like magnesium and 5-HTP and GABA and even a little bit of melatonin, I think, like the mix that you put in there. And I enjoy the taste. You know, I enjoy sitting on the couch, you know, and sipping that tea.
Yeah.
And it does work in terms of making you sleepy and kind of, I think the main thing really is to disconnect your brain a little bit to de-stress, to get you out of this, or I have to, or this guy said, or, you know, kind of thing where you just settle down, you know, mentally. I like those products. Now, you know, I'm not a fan of relying on something all the time. You should be able to just sleep. But at the same time, you know, knowing that maybe our water is not as rich in minerals anymore as, you know, actual water from a spring somewhere in the mountains. The other day, you know, I just looked at if you buy a bottle of San Pellegrino or whatever, you know, one of those mineral waters, and you look at the mineral content, they are rich in minerals, you know. And if you drink tap water, I feel like I'm dehydrated all the time. I need to supplement with electrolytes because there's nothing in that water, and you're leaching out electrolytes. So from that perspective, you know, adding some magnesium, you know, also knowing that we are, you know, exposed to elevated stress levels, you know, there is, you know, instead of once a week a saber-toothed tiger, we are now exposed to what our brain perceives as a saber-toothed tiger every single day, you know, because of social media and what have you. So there is, I think, a case to be made for magnesium and some of those maybe amino acids and stuff to kind of, you know, help and support you. But I also think that, you know, if you eat well and do a lot of things well and manage your stress well, you should be able to sleep.
Yeah, I would agree. All that stuff you mentioned, because I'm a huge fan of all that stuff too, and I think it's really great. But that's like the fruit that's higher up on the tree. That's not like the low hanging fruit. The low hanging fruit is like manage your stress, eat well, exercise during the day, go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time. Like if you just start there, most likely you're going to be sleeping really great.
Yeah. And unfortunately, for most people, you know, they just want to take that, you know, pill and don't worry about anything else. Doesn't work.
It doesn't work like that at all. What's your biggest or what's your best stress management go-to strategy? Do you do any breath work, or is it exercise? Like, is it kind of all combined?
I like the walking,
yeah,
because it really allows me to like be in my head and think through stuff. I like cold plunging, you know, sitting in there, and really that forces you to actively try something, be breathing or whatever, to get out of the fight or flight mode. Because, you know, your brain is screaming, you're dying, get out.
Yeah.
And so that's a really good tool to learn how to manage, you know, that response. Just sitting in the sun and the grass, I've noticed that it and really paying attention to how, you know, those sun rays feel in your skin. You can almost, you know, feel like you're piercing your skin, you know, and really paying attention to how does the grass feel? What do you hear? What do you smell? What do you... You know, and being there for 20 minutes just in your own head, for me, is an incredible way of disconnecting and de-stressing.
Yeah, I mean, just you describing that made me relax. Seriously, that's incredible. You're so right, though. And so it's like it's, you know, you're grounding mentally. You know, you're focusing on sights, feelings, all that stuff. But then if you're barefoot in the grass, you're actually grounding.
Right.
Which Are you a believer in the grounding? Yes. I'm a huge proponent of grounding. What we're talking about, if you guys don't know, for the audience, is like literally walking barefoot in the grass. Mm-hmm. It's incredible for you. Can you explain briefly like the science behind it? Do you know how to explain that? Well, I know it, but I can't explain it super well.
I mean, it's basically, you know, electron exchange happening. There's electricity flowing through your body when you are, you know, on barefoot on the grass. You know, if there is no rubber sole or whatever in between, it would, you know, insulate you. There are literally electrons flowing in one foot and coming out the other one. And that has a dramatic impact on some of that, you know, electron exchange in your body. I mean, there are studies now, and in the beginning, I thought that should all Google, you know.
A lot of people did.
But there is actually studies that clearly show that, you know, just by doing that, you know, you reduce your blood pressure, you know, you increase your HRV, your heart rate variability, and a lot of other, you know, biometrics that improve by just being there. And, you know, the reason is because I don't know exactly what happens when, you know, that electricity flows through your body, but it impacts the way, you know, electricity works in your body, you know, because every cell communicates by exchanging electrons, right? Yeah. And you can positively or negatively, you know, influence that. And so grounding is one way of positively, and I would argue that probably goes back to, you know, to human history. You know, that's something we've been doing unintentionally for a very long time. And so there was probably some adaptation along the way that has, you know,
invented the shoe or whatever, and then it just it went from there. Yeah. So and I remember I read the study on grounding. The research study said that 40 minutes is enough to completely alter your mm-hmm. health physiologically, you know, for the day. Mm-hmm. But also it builds up this buffer mm-hmm. against inflammation, like mm-hmm. future inflammation that's gonna, you know, try to impede on you, be it technology, toxins, whatever. You build up this buffer to where when that stuff comes in contact with you, you can actually detox it.
Right.
It's like you're charged up, right, essentially, uh-huh, which is so cool to think about.
And, you know, when I was a kid, we would run around barefoot, you know, all day. And, you know, there obviously, you know, that's not the only factor. But if you think back of, you know, maybe your parents or your grandparents, you know, how they lived. And you know, my grandparents, they're now over 90, you know, they're still kicking. And I'm like, something was different back then than it is now. And I think, you know, the grounding, there are so many factors. But if you just start, you know, ticking off one by one and try to go back to how things were, picking the best and ignoring maybe, you know, the lead paint and some of the other things that we did along the way. But you can make a significant impact in your health, and it doesn't really take much. I mean, take off your, you know, it's cheaper than wearing shoes, you know?
Yeah.
Even if, you know, people might look funny at you, but in there now even, I mean, again, if you, some of the things where you try to mitigate it with modern tools is expensive. Like I just bought a pair of Vivo barefoot shoes.
Yeah, that I really want to try those. Those things look awesome.
Yeah.
Well, they ground?
Yeah, they have now one that they have like a silver or whatever or copper in the sole. And so you actually ground while wearing those shoes. I mean,
that's so cool.
Is it worth $230, you know, to do that? I don't know. It's cheaper to go barefoot, but if you have the budget, if you, you know, think, okay, I don't want to do barefoot, but I want to do the next best thing, you know, there are ways out there on how you can kind of buy your way out of, you know, doing certain things. And you know, it's, again, can be very inexpensive, or you can spend a lot of money on all of the things. The end result is probably very comparable.
Yeah. Well, we're good on time. Let's go a few more minutes. Making sure I wasn't mm-hmm. you know, taking too much of your time. I want to definitely highlight the fact that you have a supplement line, MK Subs.
Mm-hmm.
Briefly, tell us about it, because I'm a huge fan of those supplements in particular. So tell us what you have and you know why you do it and health benefits.
Yeah. So we started out with a freeze-dried beef liver, simply because we figured, you know, I've been, as part of my blogging and reviewing, I've tried so many supplements, and you know, there is this thing called supplement fatigue, where you know, take something for a while and then you stop and maybe never come back. And I've tried so many things, but I figured, okay, what is the one thing that I think I would consume for the rest of my life? And those are organ meats. And you know, they are, depending on, you know, if you raise your own animals, it's a little bit easier. But if you're just someone who, you know, needs to source them from a third party, you know, sourcing fresh organs cannot always be easy. You know, preparation, some people don't like taste, texture, what have you. And I'm like, okay, freeze-dried, it's basically the real food, just freeze-dried, pulverized, and put into a gelatin capsule, you know. very convenient, and you know, you get your one serving of organ meat daily, yeah, by just popping four pills or four capsules, you know. And so we decided to launch a freeze-dried beef organ supplements brand, and now we've, you know, just released our first non-organ meat, a collagen and colostrum mix.
That's awesome.
And yeah, the response has been incredible. I mean, a lot of people have realized by now that, you know, eating organs is probably a good thing, best fresh, you know, if you, yeah, can. You know, I like, whenever I have access to it, you know, raw bison liver, tastes good.
You eat it raw?
Uh-huh.
No way.
Yeah, it tastes, I don't like the taste of cooked liver, to be honest.
Yeah.
I either eat it raw or in pate, or freeze-dried. You know,
that's awesome. And so where are you sourcing these organ meats from? Where
are you getting them? New Zealand.
Okay.
But we are actually in talks with domestic suppliers. Up until a couple of years ago, New Zealand was the way to go because they, you know, cattle can graze all year round. There is no winter where they have to eat hay. But now there are more and more domestic sources that do, you know, grass finished, do it well, regeneratively raised, you know, the whole nine yards. They still eat hay in winter. But as part of my, you know, venturing into the whole homesteading and rotational grazing and all of those things, I realized that if the hay is well made, it's actually not much less nutritious than fresh grass.
Good. Okay.
I did not know that. But it's one thing that I've learned. And so I'm like, okay, you know, a domestic source would make sense. So we, yeah, might have, you know, U.S. Beef organs in the future. We'll see.
Man, that's so cool, dude. I'm really glad you're doing that. I'm a big fan of organ meats. Are you familiar with Ben Greenfield?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I first heard about them on his podcast, mm-hmm, where he was talking about the benefits or whatever. Do you guys only do liver right now currently?
No, we have liver. We have an organ mix that contains five organs, okay, in the same ratio as the organ size in the animal. You know, because most other brands that I've seen out there, there are a lot of really good brands that source from the exact same ranges that we do, you know, so ingredients are the same. But you know, if you want to eat nose to tail, you know, the liver is the biggest organ, the heart is the second biggest, and I figure it only makes sense to kind of have the same ratio in the capsules.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
We have a bone and marrow, you know, for calcium and, you know, bone marrow. We have a heart and spleen specifically for, you know, exercise performance. That's like part of my warrior stack, if you will.
Dude, let's go. That's so cool, man. This is awesome.
Yeah. And yeah, next, we'll see. We're actually going to send out a survey here in the next couple of days to ask our customers what they want to have next. I'm playing with the thought of a freeze-dried oyster extract. So basically, oh, oyster flesh freeze-dried in capsules.
Yeah.
For those who like, you know, oysters.
So what's the benefit there? I'm not familiar with.
Oysters are, you know, a lot of people say they increase libido, but they're also a great source of micronutrients. It's kind of the oyster is the liver of the sea, if you will.
Okay.
So for those who want to be more on the pescatarian side or whatever, you know, that would be an option if people don't want to eat liver.
Yeah.
But there are a number of other, you know, there are testicles that contain, I mean, beef testicles actually contain testosterone, you know.
No way. Okay. So I mean, I guess that makes sense. But when you eat it, does your body
you get some of it. It's obviously not as, you know, not as effective as if you were to inject testosterone, but it also has none of the negative, you know, side effects,
right,
of injecting testosterone. Right. So you know, that's one thing that a lot of people have asked for, just as a, you know, a lot of people think it's like a penis pill, but it's not, but it really can help, you know, like support your, you know, the male organs, mm-hmm, in that area. And then the same goes with, you know, females. There is like freeze-dried ovaries and all of those things that support, because the idea is, you know, like supports like, so whatever nutrients the liver needs are found in liver.
Yeah.
Well, if you're short on any of those, you know, micronutrients, then your liver might suffer. If you eat liver, you get those nutrients that your own liver might need.
Yeah.
And the same goes with, you know, with uterus, with prostate, with, you know, testicles for that matter.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point. Did your wife eat her placenta?
No, we didn't even know about that at the time.
Really?
But yeah. Now, I mean, I would eat it.
Yeah. Well, apparently, I mean, yeah. It's, I did some research on it. I mean, it's a legit,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So my ex Sadie, she encapsulated it, mm-hmm, and then took the pills afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she seemed to respond really well to it.
Yeah.
And really enjoyed it.
Yeah. No, I would definitely, if I had known back then what I know now, that's definitely something we would do.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, man, yeah, we'll wrap it up there. I know you got to get going. Gave me an hour of your time. This is so awesome. I really appreciate you just sharing this knowledge. It's super informational for me. I'm going to apply a lot of this to my life. So where can people find you on social media?
mkumar82 is typically my handle on X and Instagram. My biggest outlet, well, I've done a Primer Shift podcast where I do what you do here as well.
Right.
Speaking of, I should have you on the show.
So yeah, that'd be awesome.
Schedule it after. But, you know, YouTube channel and then michaelkumar.com is my still my primary outlet as far as content is concerned. That's where I, you know, put all of the written content. And that's pretty much it.
It's great, man. You're doing a phenomenal job. Really, really, really appreciate this. You guys out there listening, thank you for tuning in. Apply this to your life. If you have questions, hit me up or hit Michael up. We'd be more than happy to help you. This has been another episode of the Strain Forward podcast. And as always, guys, keep moving forward. All right, that's it.
All right.
That was awesome, man. Dude, that was really, really, really good. Gosh, man, I love it, dude. You're so well read. You know your stuff. Like, man.